Welcome back to Call Time with Katie Birnbaum. I hope you enjoyed our last two awesome episodes. I'm so happy we are back in the swing of things. And I'm so happy to finally welcome my guest today to the pod. I've wanted to have him on for a while, but schedules never quite lined up until today. So a brief intro into who my guest is. He grew up outside Boston and is a graduate of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, otherwise known as CCM. Since then, he's gone on to star at shows at theaters like Barrington Stage Company, the Muni, Bay Street Theater, and the National Yiddish Theater Volkspiel in the musical Ride the Cyclone, for which he did runs at Arena Stage and at McCarter Theater. And he's currently starring as Reuben in The Chosen by Aaron Posner, which will play at both Milwaukee Rep, but actually I believe it's currently playing at Milwaukee Rep and Cincinnati Playhouse. We met doing a production at Barrington Stage when he was just a bright-eyed, college-aged intern, and I was an extremely wise 23-year-old assistant director, as I like to always remind him, due to our dramatic age disparity, I definitely see him as the future of musical theater, or also I would also refer to him as my Gen Z resource guide because I don't know anything about the Gen Z actors. So please welcome to the show, without further ado, Ellie Mayer.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having me.
I'm really glad we not only talked about how much older I am than you before we recorded and it made it into my intro. So
it's pretty much the core of our friendship at this point.
It is the core of our friendship. But I will say, it is crazy that we're still friends after all these years, really knowing each other, doing this production where we didn't interact that much.
Just, I think it all started when you gave me that recommendation for that job at the Muni.
Yeah, but surely we were already friends. If you like already had my phone number to text me that you were auditioning at the Muni, yes, that deepened it. But I think there are certain people you meet in life, and even before you interact that much, you're just like, oh, that's my type of person. And I definitely felt that way when I met you. I don't know if you felt that way at all.
I did. Yes.
Aw. Flattering. It's still weird. My first question, I'm going to get to like the beginning of your life and career, but are you willing to talk about this on the podcast? Like, why change your name? Because you're still on my phone as your name.
My birth name. Yeah. For those listening, I changed my name. My birth name is Ellie Mayer Goykman, G-O-Y-K-H-M-A-N.
Which I love, as a Jew with a hard to spell and pronounce last name as well.
Absolutely. And my middle name, Mayer, was M-E-I-R. There was a couple things to it. It was two-sided, a pragmatic side and a sort of industry side. And we can get into both. The actual pragmatic side of what pushed it over was my first name is Ellie, like Deli. So it's like Eli.
Yes.
And my last name before, when I was born, G-O-Y-K-H-M-A-N, nobody could spell, nobody could say. It was Gawkham. Most people said Gawkham or Goykham. It was butchered just beyond. So I, instead of Ellie Goykman, I was Eli Gawkham. And it was like fingernails on a chalkboard every time it was said.
Yeah.
And my equity name was Ellie Mayer since I was actually at Barrington.
It's great. I didn't know that. That's good.
It was at Barrington that I came up with Ellie Mayer. But the thing that really pushed it over, because I've changed it legally since then, so it's on all my paperwork. I know.
I'm just going to change your name in my phone. I feel bad now.
My legal name went from Ellie Mayer Goykman to Ellie Zev Mayer. The last straw, funny enough, was my car's title got messed up because the fantastic people at the Massachusetts DMV could not write my name down and copy it correctly onto official records.
Yeah.
Even though I wrote it on paper.
I believe that.
And this was happening with airline tickets. This was happening with actually very important things.
Yeah.
To the extent that I went, that's it. It's M-A-Y-E-R, Ellie Mayer, Ellie like Deli, Mayer like John Mayer or Oscar Mayer. Boom. So now I'm just Eli Mayer and I'll never escape it.
Yeah. But yeah. Eli Mayer. I do feel deep sympathy for you. I think mine is tough, but I always get Byron Boehm or things like that. But yours was a different category. This is such a personal question. Do you think when you have kids, they'll be Mayer?
I do think so. Yes. There is another side to it that I'm totally happy to talk about where...
Yeah, let's talk about it if you're... Yeah.
No, I'm an open book on this. Being Ellie Goikman, I encountered a very interesting aspect of philo-Semitism where people would hear my name of all backgrounds.
Yeah.
Revel in its Jewishness.
Yeah.
And then it would stick as this Jewish name. It wasn't just my name. It was a Jewish name. And I remember as a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed 18-year-old, that scared me in wanting to go into an industry where I wanted to be flexible, malleable in what I could be seen as, be it the nice Jewish boy. I've actually talked to Ben Fankhauser about this a couple times, of being seen as the nice Jewish boy and wanting to play something where your Jewishness is not germane to the character. It was a conscious choice as well of balancing what I say without shame is a touch of hiding it, just a touch, with it's still my name. Mayer was always my name. Ellie Mayer always felt like my name. Likewise, Mayer is a deeply Jewish last name. And my middle name, Zev, Z-E-V, is my late grandfather's Hebrew name. So at the same time, I feel that I've kept intact my Jewish identity with great pride. And I'm not really hiding it because I've just gone from one Jewish name to another. But Mayer is just a little bit more anglicized, M-A-Y-E-R, and easier to spell and get my passport scanned.
Yeah, it's not like you changed your name to like John Smith. Like that would be very different. And people have done it. I think I've told this story on the podcast. I'm not sure. But when I first graduated from college and entered the industry and was, I think, getting like EMC points or whatever, a casting director who will go unnamed was like, "Don't you want to change your name?" And I was like, "Why?" And he was like, "Isn't it a little bagel-y?" And I very pointedly was sort of like, "I'm not altering who I am. I'm proud of my heritage, blah, blah, blah. But I totally see your point." It's a fine line, right? And one of my questions was going to be to you about you just have finished and are in the middle of a spate of highly Jewish roles and highly Jewish plays. And I see both sides of it. I could totally see you being like, it's so nice for Jews to play Jews and to feel like I'm exploring this part of my identity. At the same time, I would like to play Sweeney.
Exactly.
Is that how you feel or is...
Yes. It's not that I want to hide my Jewishness. In fact, I consider myself to be much more outwardly Jewish these days than I was even when I changed my name to Ellie Mayer.
Yeah.
Furthermore, anyone who knows Jewish names hears Ellie Mayer, and I might as well be named Shlomo Metzenbaum, because it's like, as anglicized as it may seem, it's still deeply Jewish, and for that, I'm still proud of it.
Is John Mayer Jewish?
No, John Mayer is not. I don't know if Michael Mayer is, perhaps.
We could spend all day going...
Of the Mayer. I know, the Mayers.
Yeah. But my question being more like, this is skipping ahead a bit, but you're in the middle of this spate of playing these Jewish characters in highly Jewish plays. Was that something you welcomed and were excited about? And or are you also like, let me play some other roles now?
Yeah, I have found, like you said, there's two sides to that coin, that on one hand, I have to say this Yiddish theater show off Broadway that I just did, and now playing Reuven in The Chosen, has been pretty much the greatest honor of my life. like bar none, it feels like the most important theater I've done that I'm really proud to show to my family and friends. On that level, if I could do Jewish theater for the rest of my life and make a fine living off of it, I would die a happy man. If I could play every regional Leo Frank and play Reuven for a year and a half and then do Yiddish theater here and then be on the Shtiesel reboot on Netflix, whatever it is, God bless. But at the same time, of course, there's the Sweeneys out there. There's the silly co-star jock on this network show where the industry doesn't just see you as the nice Jewish boy or the guy who does Jewish stuff. And we live in an industry that, for better or worse, in my opinion, is, some people may call it tokenization. And some people likewise may call it a sort of return to form of sharing the appropriate stories of our respective backgrounds. And I did have some trepidation in taking the Yiddish show of, is this going to
box
me in? Is this going to narrow what people see from me? And like I said, I've spoken to other Jewish actors about this, and I thought maybe I was crazy, but I guess I'm not. Like, I talked to Ben Fankhauser about it, and he did Newsies, and then he brought up this idea of, yeah, now I'm just like the nice Jewish boy, and that's all good, and but I'm also Ben. And in the same way, I'm Ellie. And it's a very interesting thing where people are excited to cast you as that because they feel that they've identified someone who is quote unquote authentic to play said roles. Mm-hmm. But it has this backhanded effect where you miss out on, you know, Willard and Footloose at the Muni. Is that still within my same grasp, having now done two Jewish shows in a row? I believe that it is still. Sides to the same coin. I would love to play a Marvel superhero. Paul Rudd did it. He's Jewish, but he's Paul Rudd.
It's so tough because I think in general, the industry freaks out if they can't like place a person. And I think that's all parts of the industry, not just actors, directors, choreographers, writers. They immediately want to say, oh, this person is X. Oh, this person is Y. And people step out of that box or express a desire to step out of that box, that's really like scary and annoying to the powers that be in the industry. And I think it's true when people try to do more than one thing. And I think it's true when people try to play more than one type of role. And I hopefully think that we are living or starting to live in a time when people are more open to understanding the full identity of an artist and what the full scope of what they can do and what they hope to do. But it's definitely still an upward battle. And I get it. I think it's true what you said. There's all this debate about authentic casting. And I completely agree that should apply to Jews if we're going to apply it to other ethnic groups. So on the one hand, I'm like, yay, an actual Jew is playing Reuven in The Chosen, a Holocaust story told by actual Jews. Yes. But I totally see the flip side of that, where if you're the actor doing that, or even the director, as a director, I don't want to be the director that's like only doing Fiddler on the Roof. So I think all you can do is, you know, hone your craft and your skills and take what you want to take. Because as you said, these have been really meaningful to you as well.
Yeah. And another person that I talked to about it most recently was also Stephen Sky Bell, who's about to be Herr Schultz in the Cabaret revival. And he... amazing guy. He's probably one of the greatest actors I've ever encountered in my life in person. Mm. Consummate professional, can pretty much do anything you throw at him. And he was Tevye in The Yiddish Fiddler, which was just a masterpiece of a performance. And he said, since then, I've just been getting offers to play old Jews everywhere. And that's all that was coming in. And there's a space for everyone, I think. Hopefully we're carving out those spaces that Stephen Sky Bell can do Tevye and Herr Schultz and all of that exists. But I, yeah, it's it, to both sides of it, there's always greener grass on either side of any fence. And yeah, I'd say the way to navigate it is practicing gratitude and presence. Because if I'm spending all my time doing Willard and Footloose, worrying about that I'll never get to play a Jew and tell the story of where I come from, I'll be miserable. And if I'm spending all this time playing Reuven, worrying about what box I've been shoved into, I'll never be happy telling stories that are honest to me. On that note, I say, for as much as it seems like this cautionary tale or that I changed my name to game the industry or anything like that, I'm very grateful for where it's ended me up. And I hope that the industry continues to grow in whatever fluid direction it's going. And I think it's overall positive, whatever it is.
I completely agree. And I think the issues we're talking about are issues that obviously resonate for every group of people feeling boxed in by their race, ethnicity, religion, size, sexuality. I've spoken with a lot of friends, actors who are gay, who have felt I can only get a role that is the gay guy or the gay best friend. So I think you're totally right. In general, hopefully the industry is able to move forward, balancing both authenticity and open-mindedness. We'll see. We already got into such a deep conversation, and I'm sure my guests are like, wait, what's going on? But I do want to go back a little bit, but such an interesting discussion. Clearly, I could talk about it for a really long time.
Yeah.
I mentioned you grew up outside Boston. I asked most of my guests this question or a version of this question. Can you remember like a light bulb or aha moment from your childhood where you were like, oh, this is what I want to do. This theater is for me.
Yeah. So I was a weird kid insofar as knowing what I wanted to do without knowing how I wanted to do it. I started playing piano when I was 4. I was supposed to be one of those kids, like the concerto pianists sitting at the piano practicing. I hated it. I could not get through it. But I put in a good 12 years of classical piano. At the age of 7, I picked up dance. Everything from ballet, tap, hip hop, jazz. Caught my fair share of bullying for it, but stuck with it. Glad I did. And around 7th grade, my mother dragged me to my first audition of this terrible show. I'm sorry to say this to whoever wrote this show, but it's called Homeroom the Musical. And it's
that sounds like a dirty rock joke.
Yeah, like it was literally exactly what you think. And I, at the time, I was 12 years old, 4'10", buzz cut and braces.
True.
And I did Willkommen from Cabaret, having watched it on YouTube like 10 times, just trying to get it down. Joel Grey's Willkommen. And I got some role in it, and I did that show, and I really enjoyed it. But that is all to say that I always knew I wanted to perform. I didn't know in what capacity. I didn't know if I wanted to be a pianist, a dancer, a professional dancer, God forbid, actor, singer. I picked up singing around junior year of high school, but I was taking acting classes throughout high school and settled on theater. Not settled on theater, but I was fortunate enough to have enough green lights from the outside world signaling that I might be decent enough to do theater. And then put together a little list of colleges I wanted to audition for, and the chips fell where they did. And I was very fortunate to end up at the school that I did, University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. So from a very young age, that is all to say, I knew I wanted to perform. So I knew what I wanted to do, and I had no idea how I wanted to do it. That said, I still feel that way. I have people asking me, do you want to do more film, theater, voiceover, TV? And I say, yes, I think it's a blessing to do any of it. I'm still that kid that knows what I want to do, not entirely sure how.
It's interesting you brought up starting piano at such a young age. I didn't know that about you, but it makes sense given the fact that you are also a songwriter and musician. Mm-hmm. And one of my later questions for you was going to be about the fact that you have this other passion working simultaneously with your theater career. I know you released an album Has that been difficult to maintain alongside musical theater? And something I talk about a lot on the show, which we already talked about, is like the industry's inability to see people as full dimensional artists. So yeah, tell me about that aspect of your career in artistry.
So I have been producing music, mixing, writing songs, the whole shebang for about, I want to say 5-6 years now. And during COVID, I released this album under Ellie Mayer called Self/Made. And it is both a hobby and a passion that if I stumbled into some level of monetary success, like I would pivot in a day, truly.
Really?
Yeah. If someone wanted to slap me with a contract today, God bless. But it is its own industry that I'm finding that the threshold from hobby to profession is just like theater, who the connections you have, you know, knowing the studio spaces, knowing session musicians. So like I have a 6-song EP that I have sitting on my phone right here next to me that I've been working on for about 1.5 years. But releasing it as something that I think would match taste and not just a cringy little album to push out and really taking it to that next level requires that sort of level of connection that is hard juggling two industries. It's almost like being a theater actor, being in with all the casting directors that do theater in New York, and then going to LA and trying to book a pilot. You realize it's a completely different set of people you have to know, vernacular, places to be, but it has been a godsend as far as a creative outlet in an industry where we're waiting to make theater and waiting for someone to give us a green light. I've been fortunate enough since then to be commissioned to actually write some musical pieces for everything from original high school pieces, musicals, to some industrial stuff, writing little jingles for big companies.
Yeah.
And so to that extent, I have stumbled into it a little. And I hope that this next EP is actually better than the first one, markedly.
That's awesome. That's really cool. I'm very proud of you for that. I think it's really important to keep up all of your interests and like I said, try to be like a 360 version of an artist. Because as you mentioned, there's a lot of waiting around and powerlessness in our industry, especially as an actor. Something I used to really struggle with is that lack of agency and control. Is that something that you struggle with? Are you like more of a type A person or are you more of a type B person?
Very type A.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I have found that the sneaky, most difficult thing about being an actor that I now wave as my torch to the younger actors that ever ask me anything. I say younger actor as if I'm not 24.
Yeah, let's say.
It's the idea of being available. Nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about the hardest part, in my opinion, in my subjective opinion, is not the rejection. It is not the financial compensation. It is not the toils of New York. It is this idea that as actors, because our work is so unpredictable, we must constantly be available. You want to go home and perhaps see your family? There's a sense of trepidation that comes with it because what if I have an audition? You want to take a 5-week language intensive. For example, I've been thinking of taking a little language intensive over the summer, but all of a sudden you're not available for 5 weeks. And you start to get this weird feeling of, can I live my life? Can I meet new friends? Can I travel? Can I undertake new hobbies and learning experiences? Can I be available for the other parts of my life that need nourishing? And when you're not working and you just need to be available for whatever job comes along or might come along or might not come along, you're just waiting. And doesn't even necessarily connect to the idea of needing to perform and nourish that part of you. it's just wanting to be a 360 person living each day in the world. And instead, here you are maintaining a status of availability. And that has been the trickiest thing that nobody has talked about that I have come up against in the last few years.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it. I definitely think that's true and something that people, sometimes certain people outside of the industry can struggle with, like the concept of, oh my God, you might miss a wedding, or oh my God, you might miss a christening or bris or whatever it is. Just like no understanding that we work on weekends and that we have to fight for every single paid out or permitted out is really a thing. But I want to free you from that, because if you want to take a language intensive over the summer and you haven't booked yet, I know it's probably like a financial question, but you can't let yourself not live your life, as you said, right? And you have to take the advantages of what we do where they come. So if you have a month free and you have always wanted to go to Japan and you're in a financial position to do, I say go for it. Mm-hmm. The worst thing that happens is you get trip insurance and you can't go because you are booked and blessed. But that is a really interesting perspective that I hadn't really thought about.
That was a shift that I had to make, I think, in the last year and a half. That was, I think, punctuated by me starting officially my own business, because I'm also a strength coach and a personal trainer. I have my own roster of private clients. I do online coaching. I have in-person coaching. So I have my little brand, Easy M Training, that has this little Instagram account and whatnot. That idea that I was like, you know what? No, I have to live my life. It was punctuated by that, but it was a learning experience in coming to that realization that that I spent a year and a half trying to be available. And it's one thing to be unavailable because you're working. God bless, one blessing overrides another blessing. But it's to be available when not working. That is such a sort of mind bender that, yeah, I think we as people in the industry have to take a real forward initiative in living our lives without this feeling of opportunity cost.
Totally. It's a mind fuck for sure, especially for the things that feel most important in life.
Right.
Like a major life decision.
Yeah. That's really the stuff that I'm thinking about. Like language intensive, sure. Traveling, sure. It's the life stuff that people in other industries that us theater people call quote unquote muggles or normal jobs that have stability and predictability. You watch your peers in those industries develop their lives in certain ways that are not necessarily afforded to you. Yeah, family, life, buying property, God forbid, like this stuff that is life stuff that they don't teach in school, that they don't talk about. They talk about how you deal with rejection. They talk about how to focus on your craft to get better for the next audition. And they focus on finding your secondary passion to keep you sane when you're not working. That's all covered beautifully. But they don't talk about being a person and developing a life.
I would argue, though, dating someone seriously who works in big law, which is incredibly intense in different ways than theater and certainly more stable, but the hours are way more insane. And so at least in these two industries, it's similar questions, right? And I have a lot of friends in finance who feel the same way. And so I think it's just a matter of, as you get older, like learning what your priorities are. And also I think our generation, specifically your generation, is
my five years younger generation.
It makes the difference. I did not have an iPhone until I was 16. When did you get your first iPhone?
15, 16.
Okay. When did you get your first social media?
13 or 14.
Okay. That's the difference. 16. And then Instagram for me was like 18, 19.
Whoa.
Can you believe? But my point being that, like, I think a lot of people in both of our generations are a bit over-therapized and a bit just like everything has to be like really massaged and thought out and blah, blah, blah. And at a certain point, it's like, okay, just make a decision, because you can be held back by the inertia, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Deep. Okay.
I had a sophomore acting teacher. I'll just say this.
No, please.
Because I'm in complete agreement. And that's what I mean. You got to make the decision to live your life. You think that you're just going to arrive in New York and your life is just going to start happening, but you actually have to make an active decision to live your life.
Yeah.
And my sophomore acting teacher, her like saying, instead of salt and pepper, it was fuck it and just do it.
Mm.
And just sprinkle that on everything.
I think that's such good advice for everything, really. I know that the stakes feel higher as we get older, but they're not that high.
Yeah.
I think of you, again, our age difference, as like definitely part of the pandemic, like COVID generation. I remember watching your college showcase on YouTube, I believe, when you sent the link. And so I'm just curious, at such a crucial time period for anyone, but certainly someone in the industry, like doing the showcase, moving to New York. It sounds like you moved to New York in like kind of peak pandemic. What was that vibe for you?
Yeah, I was a junior. March, what was it, 19th, 20th, 2020, reaching the end of my junior year, about to become a senior. And COVID hit, we all went home. I spent all of senior year of my conservatory training in Zoom University with some hybrid training. And big props to all of the teachers and educational institutions that did their best on the fly with the information that they had and resources they had. Looking back, there was so much complaint about not getting your money's worth and all, and that all is valid. But looking back, I have so much sympathy for the teachers and the people who had to form those curriculums on the fly. But I had to spend senior year in Zoom University with a fully virtual showcase and graduated in May of 2021 and moved to the city basically right away. I was so silly back then because I thought that the industry was going to be like back by early 2022. There was so much optimism that the really harsh lockdown was ending and we were at the bottom of the dip on the up and up. So I moved to the city, frankly, with a great deal of optimism and got a fantastic deal on an apartment, of course, that then doubled my rent the next year. So I had to move.
Wow.
Yeah. And the weirdest revelation about this whole thing is that people love to say offhandedly, it's slow. Oh, it's slow right now. Oh, it's the summer. It's slow. Oh, it's the holidays. Sure. It's slow.
It's always slow.
It's somehow always slow. You always hear that. But now that we're really 3 years into post or mid, whatever you want to call it, 3 years into this post-COVID world, mm-hmm. it's been slow for 3 years. And trying to get a foothold in the industry has been interesting because I don't have the credibility of a seasoned actor who had a great deal of clout pre-COVID that we all have to pick up the pieces. I'm not just saying that us youngins are the victims of a desolated industry. Everyone's going through it. But specifically, speaking to the experience of someone trying to get a foothold in this industry, hearing the trope of it's slow, and now 3 years later being like, wow, it's actually slow. It's actually slow for 3 years. And watching regional theater really tried to get itself going, even 3 years later, the regional theater conundrum has been my great interest of the last year and a half. That and the construction of high-speed rail in the U.S. have been my greatest
nerd. You have too much time on your hands.
too much time.
That's so interesting that you say that, though, because we were talking a bit before we started recording about, I obviously have followed your career, but was doing some more research before the episode. And I think that it is to your credit how many credits, really good credits, you have amassed in the, I guess, 3 years since you graduated college and were in the industry despite the slowness. And I think there are two things that you should be really proud of, one of which connects to what you were saying, is you have really worked at an impressive list of good regional theaters. And I'm a big believer in regional theater. I, too, think that most of them are really suffering and hurting right now. So I'm curious for your thoughts. You've clearly been thinking about that a lot on the regional theater conundrum, right?
Yeah. First off, thank you. That is very kind of you. And I recognize the good fortune I've been able to have through this stormy weather that we've had. So that's point one. I think regional theater needs to rethink the way it does theater. Mm-hmm. I think for a very long time, I think for the last 50 years, we've seen theaters get built and create subscriber bases, very loyal subscriber bases that are the core of their viewership. And these subscriber bases are shrinking. They are aging out. They are, for many reasons, the same subscriber bases that people had 30, 40 years ago. And I think theaters are starting to realize that customer acquisition in any business is very important, but they're all about 10 years behind on it. They're trying to get creative with co-productions, splitting costs. The hot thing is always transferring a show and then getting clout and buzz on that. But I think theater as a space, if you are a regional theater, it is my opinion, again, subjective, what do I know, that you either need to diversify what your space is used for to diversify streams of income. So it's not enough to have a fine lobby. You should have a gorgeous lobby that people want to have weddings in. That's one avenue. Speaking engagements, where it becomes a cultural hub of whatever community you belong to. Arena Stage, frankly, does this very successfully. They have basically event spaces and outreach programs that bring people to their building, perhaps not exactly their theater, but then they become a mainstay of their market. That, or you got to get creative with your marketing. We have to bring young people to the theater where price is an extreme barrier. No one wants to pay $79 for a 2-hour evening at the theater.
Cheap.
It's just not cheap. It's impossible.
Yeah, but I'm saying that's cheap for a good side Broadway, but a good regional theater, like tickets for hundreds, $200.
Yeah. So the average ticket is really like $120, $130. Mm-hmm. You could go to an NFL game for $45. When at the end of the day, we're competing for people's attention, which is real estate at the end of the day. When you come out with a new song, every 2 minutes that you get someone to listen to your song, they have to choose your song over anything else they could do. And price is a big barrier. Buzz is another big barrier. Meaning, if you're not a subscriber to a theater and you are just a member of a market, you live in Chicago, you live in Boston, you live in Austin, you live in Seattle, and you're just someone who lives there, it's very unlikely that anyone listening to this podcast who doesn't do theater, so probably very few people, but the people who aren't in the sort of beat of theater, they can't tell you what show their big regional theater is doing. They can't even tell you what show is happening, let alone if it's a show that they would be interested in seeing. And that is a huge gap that I think we have to close, that theaters have to stand their ground as mainstays of any market they're in that doesn't just appeal to the people who are already going to go to the theater. So I don't know how we bring prices down. I'm not a producer yet. Maybe I can actually ask you about that. And diversifying the sort of sources of income that a theater becomes a venue above all else, and rethinking the subscription model because it's clearly not working the way it should be. I think we need to get creative with the way we sell tickets, with the way that we make ourselves known in any community. I think it has much less to do with programming and the shows themselves, because regional theaters are constantly doing fantastic work and moving forward into bold, new, brave spaces. And people don't know about them. People don't even know the shows that are happening. But you just produced this wonderful production of Sunday in the Park with George that was pretty cutting edge at Axelrod. So maybe, actually, if anything, I can hand the mic to you to talk about what you did there and what worked.
First of all, I was going to say, are you sure you didn't go to grad school? Because that those are just like all the conversations we had in grad school. What I did for Sunday was very specific. I did not work for Axelrod. I worked for the production. I frankly was not very concerned with putting butts in seats. And that sounds bad, but I wasn't. My loyalty was to the production and getting the production to move forward. So if anything, I had a very backwards and narrowed with blinders on approach. I wanted to get critics and commercial producers and regional theaters to the show. And we were effective in doing that. I haven't yet reviewed how well the show sold. I know that, as you said, theater was taking something of a risk on this production, not only because it was cutting edge, but also it's Sondheim in the winter on the Jersey Shore. However, I took a lot of Ubers while I was up there, and everyone seemed to know about the production. To your point, I think you're probably right that when you go do a show at New Haven, not every person in New Haven knows what Yale Rep is doing, but they might know, oh, Coldplay's coming to perform, or, oh, the basketball. New Haven doesn't have a basketball team, but
right.
And I think we've lost that. It used to be that way, and that's why every major city in the United States had a regional theater and built those in the post-war period. I also think your point is very valid about diversifying streams of income, and everyone is trying to do that, but then it becomes like, how do you have the funds to make your space really beautiful so that people will have weddings there? And then that honestly comes down to like fundraising and funding. And I think that's a much longer, more complicated question that is connected to the death of our American cities besides New York and LA and Miami. There used to be like several successful leaders of the community in every city or town who felt that it was part of their duty to contribute to these cultural centers. And I think, A, those people don't see that as important anymore, and B, don't really exist in a lot of cities anymore. So then the place of the government becomes way more important, and the government doesn't have the money. So it's a vicious cycle. I think at least in New York, one of the major failures of off-Broadway and regional theaters is capturing the philanthropic imagination of the rich people that are in their 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. All the boards say they have people who are in their 60s and 70s on the board, nobody younger. And they exist. They're just not giving their money to us. A lot of stuff brought up there, but I think the way you're thinking of it is so smart and so great to hear an actor as opposed to a producer or an arts administrator thinking about all these questions. So I hope that you're talking to your other actor friends about that stuff.
They get tired of it pretty quickly, but I'm talking to them nonetheless.
That's good. My next question about how unique your career has been is that I think you had a really amazing opportunity in Ride the Cyclone, which has had really exciting success. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that experience.
So Ride the Cyclone was a very interesting animal in that it's had a life. It did run off Broadway in 2016.
Okay.
Where Gus Halper played Misha Baczynski. And it's done many regional theaters and it's bounced around. But it opened I believe, 3 weeks before the 2016 election. And it just wasn't the right time. And it closed really fast. But it from that formed a massive cult following and went quiet for a while, especially with COVID. And then it resurfaced with this new momentum where we got to do it at the McCarter Theater. And it was a sort of tentative co-production with Arena Stage. And initially, I thought it was just another regional contract of Ride the Cyclone. But, and this is where it was a new show, because we were tweaking it all over again. There were changes happening left and right. It had the energy of a new show. It was trying to pick up commercial producers. It was trying to get critics out there. It was trying to create buzz as this show. And there was talk of everything from further regional theaters to straight to New York. I heard a slight whisper of West End. It was like way too much buzz. Most of it probably wasn't true. But for all intents and purposes, with the way that the production was being treated, it was treated like a new show. And we were actually lucky enough to have Jacob Richmond, the writer of the show, in DC with us working on it at Arena. It was awesome. And coinciding with this TikTok wave, we caught that momentum and caught this fan base. We had kids driving from Georgia to Washington, D.C. And we had kids in the area, an hour, 2 hours away, seeing the show 12 times. And
wow.
It was just like that Playbill article said, why Gen Z loves Ride the Cyclone. And we were outside that stage door most days talking to people 10, 15, 20 minutes. It was a really sort of special thing. But jumping to working on the character, it was an interesting experience that someone had touched it before. Many people had done it before. The Ride the Cyclone fans can list you all of their favorite Mishas and Jane Does and Knowles and all of this stuff. Having the writer there, getting to work on it and redefine what I thought about the character, it was also a very special time to do that character, because about a month before the Ukraine invasion is when I booked Misha Baczynski, who is a Ukrainian character. Mm. It's not referenced in the show. It's not really brought up, but you could feel it in the air every time it was said on stage. And it felt like that moment, in that every time the narrator would say, Misha was born in Ukraine, everyone would hold their breath a little bit. The war was raging on throughout both productions, as it still does. And getting to do that, not as someone from Ukraine, but my grandfather was born in Odessa, and I'm the son of Soviet immigrants, so I felt a certain level of connection to it. That was a story that, although not Jewish, actually connected to a deep part of myself. And I got to yell on stage every night, Slava Ukraina, Geroyam Slava, which is glory to Ukraine, glory to the heroes, every night. And there was a night where we actually had a group of probably 100 exchange students, half of them from Ukraine,
wow,
who saw the show. And I got to yell that in front of those kids. And it was one of those moments where theater becomes more than just theater. And I had messages from these kids saying, it felt like I was home for 5 seconds when you yelled that. It just like seeing that, I miss home terribly. So there was this sort of resurrection of momentum on a show that had been bouncing around. And likewise, it was being done at a very unique moment.
Yeah, I forgot about those elements of the show and when you were doing it. That must have been really powerful. I just want to shout out, when you said people drove from Georgia, there were two people who came opening weekend of Sunday who had driven from North Carolina to New Jersey to see the show. And I think they said it was like an 11-hour, 12-hour drive. So
wow.
Those are the types of fans that make it worth it. Wow. A lot to say based on that. You brought up this article, Gen Z, TikTok, et cetera. You and I have a mutual friend who has come on this podcast and made his feelings very known about social media and years of social media. I feel like something I end up talking with most of my guests who are my age or younger is about the role of social media in a young actor's career nowadays and the pressures of that, but also how you can make it work for you. And I'm curious for your perspective as my resident Gen Z friend.
Of course. Just my pleasure to be the ambassador of Gen Z.
Thank you.
Thought and philosophy to you, since you're so far out from that generation. And
yeah,
it's like we just don't see eye to eye, clearly.
You have to realize, in addition to being a millennial, whereas you are Gen Z, I'm like I hate to use the phrase old soul, but I am. Like, I can deal with technology. My favorite books are Jane Austen books. I don't have TikTok. I've never had it. I never want it. So a lot of this stuff has to be spelled out for me.
So our 5-year gap is truly magnified by virtue of the age of our souls.
Yes, you have a young soul and I have an old soul. It's obvious to anyone.
For the record, I've had numerous castmates call me an old curmudgeon, and in Yiddish, an Altakacker, many times over. So I might also have not just an old soul, but a curmudgeoned soul. So we might be closer than you think. But
little
in
Larry
this,
kid.
Right, a Larry David, if you will. But if in this body, I am obviously the banner holder, the torchbearer for the Gen Z.
So much younger, yeah.
As far as social media goes, it used to be pitched to us as a portfolio of sorts. You should make yourself seen. You should post your work. You should make an effort to ABCDEFG because it will be an assistive mechanism in getting you seen and cast, because it's something for people to see outside of your audition. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think it is a useful tool to create two things. One is a sense of relevance that, and this is tricky because social media is fake, this idea of creating relevance is really toxic in and of itself. But the advantage of social media is that we get to keep these very large circles of acquaintances, huge circles of acquaintances, that you scroll past people every day and hundreds of faces, for better or for worse. And every time you see someone's face, be it doing a show, be it getting ice cream, somebody's getting married, something's going on, everybody has their own little pocket of relevance that even if you're not talking to that person every day, or let alone for a year and a half, it's a way that if you run into someone, they go, oh yeah, you've been like all over the place doing stuff. And there's no casting directors going to your page to check if you're a good dancer or singer. And there's very few people that are going to cast you based on your number of followers or whatever it may be. But it allows this sense of buzz. You get to create your own buzz, for better or for worse. Again, there are many sort of toxic traits to that, this pressure to create buzz. This idea that you have to present yourself a certain way, this idea that you have to capitalize on your real experiences for the sake of others noticing, which I think have serious drawbacks to them. So in all things, it's a balance. So one is creating relevance. And the other one is, it's frankly a great way to make low stakes connections. If you are interacting with other people's material, swiping up on a story, congratulating someone on a job, whatever it may be. And also outside of professional stuff, just someone posts ice cream and you're like, where is that? All of a sudden, you're now speaking with someone, building a connection with people, and your circles are growing. People know who you are, who people are, and it takes down the barriers of having to meet people in the first place. Because now you have this massive circle of acquaintances that, frankly, if you ran into them, you would feel like older friends than you are. You've never met this person, but like, we've interacted on social media, so it feels like I know you. Here we go. Again, side of that coin, does that dilute the friendships and attention that we do have? Does that falsify otherwise honest connections? Two sides to every coin. My opening line in The Chosen is Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. Both these and these are the words of the living God. It's basically the thesis of the show. So, not to literally apply Talmudic scholarship to Instagram. But
I've been done before, yeah.
But both these and these. It's a tool. It's useful if you can use it right with pure intentions. But it has its dangers. Above all else, it's my little photo album that I get to look back on. It's my little scrapbook. Mm-hmm. And I think that keeps a healthy space in my brain that I post what I like. It's my scrapbook. And whatever comes with it is fantastic, but it's mine.
It's nice to hear you say everyone was always freaking out that casting directors would cast based on follower count. And they don't do that. Maybe a few, obviously, if you're a celebrity, if you're Elle Fanning, that's going to come into consideration. But if you have 2,500 followers versus 4,500 followers, I actually don't think that makes a difference in theater casting. I will say that as a director, I do, and most directors I work with do, I do check in on the vibe. I do a vibe check and I do make judgments, and sometimes casting decisions are made or changed based on the vibe of your social media, because you can unfortunately tell, or fortunately, tell a lot about a person based on what they're posting.
That is very true. Something I skipped over. It's a supplement insofar as it does help you create a vibe. And so long as you keep it honest to, like, it's my little scrapbook. It's like, it's, I have to like my page. I have to like whatever it is that it is, because then that's connected to me. And then whatever supplement of creating a vibe it is, it's a useful 100%. I could not agree more that.
Or not someone's, if you have a bad vibe.
Or I have a bad vibe, right.
Because also my idea of a bad vibe is my own idea of a bad vibe. If I'm directing a show versus someone else, and I see something on Instagram that I find very off-putting, that another director might find
on-putting,
that another director might find appealing or just neutral. Like, I have a lot of friends who say they only use Instagram for work now. So, like, promoting their work, pictures of the work they make, production shots, etc., for obvious reasons. And I definitely still use it for both, but I would say 60% of my posts are about work.
I totally agree. And I think that's another astute evaluation of the medium in that, yeah, it's a vibe check.
Because there's no one uses LinkedIn in our business.
Right. And I say that all the time. If I wasn't an actor, I probably would not have the Instagram presence that I do, because I'm an actor and it is a vibe check. Like, it's totally a vibe check. Because it's a vibe check, okay, now it's part of it. It doesn't have to be. Your vibe could be not having an Instagram. That could be your vibe.
It's funny because my boyfriend has no social media, which when I started dating him, I was like, that's extremely hot. Love that. If I was casting him in a show, I don't know. Would I find that hot and intriguing, or would I be like, that's weird? I'm not sure. I think if you are already famous, you don't have to have a vibe. You don't have to have an Instagram.
Something is going to come along in 20 years when I feel like an old soul. I'm going to be looking at the kids being like, oh my God, how are you guys navigating this?
I feel that way about TikTok. As I said, I don't have it. And if you send me a TikTok, I'll watch it. But who knows? Ellie, I could clearly spend all evening talking to you. My last question before we do a little ending fun segment. You've alluded to this already, but do you have any advice for aspiring actors or aspiring artists who might be listening?
Advice to aspiring actors? Yes. Find your other dream job. Laura Michelle Kelly gave me this advice when I was but a youngin. Find your other dream job, something that fills you. For me, that's fitness and strength and training people. And second, go to therapy. Go to therapy. Work on yourself as a person. Oh, my goodness, golly gosh. This industry is about just being a good person, a 360 person that people want to be around or can work with or whatever you want to say. And that starts with forming yourself or growing yourself into a version of yourself that is the best version of yourself that makes you a full and good person. I live life, experience emotions, events, loss, pain, happiness, joy, and reflect on them, take them in, and grow from that. From there, you will find success in whatever form it comes. That is my greatest piece of advice in my short life that I can give.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really good advice, especially with the vagaries of our industry. You have to learn how to like yourself and look at yourself in the mirror when you have no work and just got it going. I want to do my ending segment, which is the thank you five segment, which is five rapid fire questions. So just answer off the top of your head. It's a lot of favorites, so you can pick a couple.
I'm ready.
First of all, do you have a dream role or roles?
Dream role or roles? I would love to be Shakespeare in Something Rotten, and I would love to be Jerry Lee Lewis in Million Dollar Quartet.
I feel like both of those are very achievable for you.
I hope.
Do you have any dream collaborators that you've yet to work with? So this could be anyone, like another actor, or it could be like a director, choreographer, writer.
I have the utmost respect for Tom Stoppard. If I somehow ended up in a room with him, I don't know what I would do with myself.
I love that. Is there a Jewish play or musical that you know of that you feel doesn't get done a lot that you think should be done more?
That is a good question.
It's funny because, in my opinion, so many plays and musicals have a Jewish sensibility. So, yeah.
The trendy answer a year ago would have been Parade, but I have a feeling that would have been my answer, truly. I really wanted to see Wholesale at Classic Stage.
Oh, it was so good.
I so wanted to see that. And even though I didn't see it, I'm going to say that one.
Love it. I saw it first preview. It was great. My last question, designed for you. What is a Gen Z actor essential? So as a Gen Z actor, what do you think is an essential? And this could be like as simple as a really good microphone, or it could be like a sense of humor or something like that.
A Gen Z actor essential humidifier.
Wow.
I don't know what I would do on this contract without my humidifier that company management so graciously gave me. I would
because
die without
it's so dry in the Midwest.
It's dry. It's honestly, these radiators in Milwaukee are very New York-esque. I feel like I'm home a lot. They clang and they dry out the apartment like crazy.
Yeah.
Sleep hygiene stuff. Sleep hygiene, whatever that is, Gen Z, go for it.
I'm one of those people that I get really bad nosebleeds when it's dry. And when I was in Paducah, Kentucky for Annie, I started getting these horrible nosebleeds because my hotel room was so dry. Yeah, I don't know, there's no point to that story, but it's tough out there. Ellie, this was so fun. I feel like we covered such a plethora of topics. You're so great to talk to. Is there anything you feel like we've missed that you want to mention or talk about, or anything you want to plug? You could talk about The Chosen and where it's playing, if we have any listeners in those areas.
First off, thank you for having me. I have been a fan of the show since it's begun, and it's so cool to be on it, truly. So thank you to you. You are a wonderful and gracious host with really good questions. And The Chosen is closing up at Milwaukee Rep this next week. And by the time this episode comes out, it is likely that we'll be deep in our run at Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park at the main stage Jack Rouse Theater. It is the greatest honor of my life to play this role, and I hope anyone who is in the area can come see it, and anyone who's not in the area wants to move it and give it more life, because I think this show deserves to be done more than it is. So maybe The Chosen is my Jewish show answer, actually.
Yeah, I was saying before we started recording, it's my grandpa's favorite book, and I'm sure he would love to see the play. I don't think he's going to fly out to Cincinnati, but let's get it there. They live in Hartford, maybe a Hartford stage.
Maybe.
Situation, a Berkshire situation, a New York situation, lots of possibilities.
It's a cheap show to run, and it's a very good show that's never played New York. So I hear trumpets for that, or clarinets if it's klezmer.
Love it. Thank you again, Ellie. Such a great episode. So many topics. As always, if you have thoughts, leave a comment, send me a DM. Please rate and subscribe to our show and give us 5 stars if you like what you hear. We have some amazing guests lined up. I'm so happy to be back in the rhythm of things. And I hope all my call time listeners have a great week.